Was Heather Ayoub. This is BBC Radio 4, where we take to the great outdoors now, where the aftermath of a particularly stormy night is at the heart of today's episode of Plants, From Roots to Riches, presented by Professor Cathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew.
The Arboretum here at Kew is, in my view, a perfect microcosm of the English landscape. Sturdy spreading oak, ash and beech trees stand sentinel amidst a host of other species, as they have in the parks and woods of England for centuries. As dawn broke on October the 16th, 1987, this scene looked very different. It was the morning after a great storm in which hurricane-force winds ripped through southern England, recording gusts of 110 miles per hour and bringing down a staggering 15 million trees in a few hours. Here at Kew, 700 trees lay flattened on the ground. But the carnage reaped some surprising benefits. Experts were able to rewrite the textbooks on a number of aspects of tree care, how we build resilience into the landscape, and indeed what role arboretums should play today. In this episode, we're on a walk to examine the hurricane's legacy. Tony Kirkham, head of Kew's Arboretum, is showing me around. And we're starting with a remarkable story from that night of carnage. It centres around an oak tree, a Quercus turneri, an elegant hybrid cross between an English oak and a holly oak. It's been here a long time, given to Princess Augusta, Kew's founder, in 1783 by an amateur gardener called Mr. Turner. It's a beautiful specimen, dense and spreading, the perfect English tree. And Tony Kirkham, on the night of the great hurricane, it did something very peculiar indeed.
4 o'clock in the morning, I remember it very well, and most people who look after trees or have an interest in trees will remember that evening. The whole tree lifted out of the ground, so the whole root plate that we are stood on lifted and cracked and exposed some of the roots. But luckily, because it's got this very low branching habit, the tree literally sat back down into the hole that it had made and didn't fall over.
What did you and your team then do the morning after the hurricane? I mean, did you have some sort of triage system in place to decide which trees to deal with?
When we came in on the morning, it was doom and gloom. Over 200 years of tree history gone or damaged in that one night. I suppose we went round just to assess what had happened, to make sure things were safe. Obviously we had a massive clean-up operation ahead of us, and we decided to leave this tree to the end, and this would be the last tree that we would cut up.
When you eventually got to it, what had happened to it?
Well, before the hurricane, we'd been monitoring the health of it, like we do with all our other trees in Kew, and what we'd noticed is that it was going into decline. The leaves were very small on it, so the density of the canopy was very thin. We wouldn't have been able to shelter under it today. And we didn't really know the reason why. And then after 3 years of clearing up, we came back to this tree to deal with it. And remarkably, it was a picture of health.
So how on earth did bodily wrenching the roots from the ground before the whole tree thumped back down again improve the oak's health?
Basically, because of the high visitor numbers that we have at Kew, and because this was such a popular tree to shelter under, this tree had basically been suffering for a long time, unbeknown to us, from compaction. So basically, overnight, the storm broke up the compaction, got oxygen down to the roots, allowed water to get into the roots, and then the tree started its second life. And it's put on a third of its overall size in the last 26, 27 years since the hurricane.
So did you suspect many other trees also having the same problem in Kew?
All the other trees in Kew, particularly our heritage trees and our big trees that we do decompaction work to, owe their future to this tree. This is the tree that sort of set the scene for a lot of the remedial work that we do around tree roots. Today we use a tool called an air spade, pushing compressed air in, which runs through the soil, shatters the soil around the roots without damaging the roots. A remarkable piece of kit that, you know, I think has revolutionised the tree world.
So Tony, there were all these losses as a result of the hurricane. What did you do to start filling the gaps?
First of all, we had a blank canvas to work on, which is a unique opportunity. And one of the important things that we had to get right was tree establishment in these gaps. And so we started to look very closely at how we plant trees. We should have a walk, and I'll show you some young trees that have been planted since the hurricane.
Tony, you've brought us to the edge of the Arboretum, where we can look back on 240 acres that make up the collection of trees here. And we're surrounded by some very young American ash. These, what, 2 years old? Each just 2 metres high, nurtured from seed, and very carefully planted, I see.
Well, you're absolutely right. We're in the ash collection now, which is probably one of our most important collection holdings in the Arboretum, mainly because of the threats to the ash tree. We're looking for 100% success rate to replenish the collections from the hurricane. So one of the things we looked at was, how do we plant trees and how can we be more successful? Because we only get one go at some of these.
So what did you learn?
The first thing we did was to trawl all the scientific research. You talk to people and they say, oh, we need more research in this, we need more research in that. In actual
that's
fact, that's typical science.
Yep.
And there is a huge amount of research from America, from Europe, from Australia, from Asia on tree planting. And basically we trawled through it and pulled out the pieces that we thought would be more appropriate to tree planting in a temperate climate, and came up with probably the first tree planting specification at Kew. So we found, you know, from the hurricane, from the tree root survey, we realised that tree roots were shallow. You know, at school we were all taught that what you see above ground is what you get below ground, and across the southeast of England, 15 million trees blew over, and they all had very shallow root plates, which was a bit of a rude awakening for us. It was a surprise, you know, and tree root plates between half a metre and a metre deep at the best of times.
I think that'd still be a big surprise to many people.
And even to professionals, Cathy, that work on trees all the time, it's very difficult to comprehend. And here at Kew, from the tree root survey, we know that there are very few roots deeper than 800 millimetres, and they sit on this raft, and it's all about friction and spread to stand up. Now, we were digging tree pits over a metre deep. In 200 years, those tree roots are never going to go down to the bottom of that hole, so why are we digging trees too deep? Most trees are killed by being planted too deep. It's a slow, painful death for a tree.
And what about the shape of the hole? I mean, is there anything to learn from that?
We complain about trees grown in circular pots because the roots spiral, and so we looked at all different shapes and eventually came up that the square hole was the easiest to dig, and you've got four corners that the roots can break out of, and they're very quick to look for moisture. And also, you'll notice we plant small. We don't need to stake, and tree staking damages trees, and you've got to prepare these trees for the next hurricane, the next 1987 storm. And if we put tree stakes and supports and canes and tie these trees up, then they don't get used to being moved, and they need to move. Any wind, they sway, and that sway motion encourages good anchor roots, increased increment on the trunk to support the crown, and they're ready for the next storm. We call that seismomorphogenesis.
So you've just turned all my understanding about tree planting on its head.
But it's all good stuff, and you know, it's based on observation, trialing things, and research papers.
And natural ecosystems.
And natural ecosystems.
Tony, yeah. Can we walk further into the Arboretum to see some of the other trees you've planted?
Yeah, that'd be fine. I'd love to show you.
How do you think people feel about changing their treescape? I mean, should we view treescapes as fixed, or should we be more broadly accepting of change and see it as an important event to replenish the landscape?
Certainly, you know, if we go back to Dutch elm disease, that was a rude awakening to how one disease and an insect can change the landscape, the treescape of the British Isles, and it woke everybody up. The hurricane did exactly the same. It made everyone look at trees. Suddenly, we lost 15 million trees in the southeast of England in one night. And it changed the treescape. It changed the horizon, certainly the southeast of England. We've got threats from disease and climate. So, for me, the treescape of the British Isles is constantly changing. And I think we'll change more quickly now than it has in the past.
So, what you're creating here at Kew is a resilient landscape.
I hope so, and I think looking around, I hope you agree that you can see that we're establishing trees and they're
Absolutely.
Looking pretty good.
Between all the hard work, did you have any time for philosophical reflection on what role an arboretum should play today?
It should be about education, conservation, you know, the threats that trees face, and also use it for research into good tree management. So we've got this living library here that's available for us to sell these messages.
How's it laid out?
It's laid out according to the Bentham and Hooker system, and Hooker, the first director, laid out the collections in family order. What he said was that if a scientist can find his way around the herbarium, then they should be able to come out into the arboretum and find any tree, because it's in the same layout as the herbarium in family order. I don't think that works both ways, because, you know, I've been here a long time and I know my way around the arboretum, but I still can't navigate the herbarium, so there's something wrong.
It would be interesting to bring some taxonomists out here, actually.
That's right, I'd like to see them.
The clearance provided by the hurricane must have been an incredible opportunity to gather some important new species. How did you determine what to collect?
We were able to look at weaknesses within the families and then identify where we needed to go to collect those.
And where did you go?
Well, one of my first trips was to South Korea in 1989, so 2 years after the hurricane. And South Korea is an incredible place. The vegetation is it's almost a hybrid between Japan and China. And it's a place that not many people visit. But the plants there grow really well here in the arboretum, and we knew that from past collections. We also had expeditionary work going into China. We were targeting the Far East, in effect.
Following in the footsteps of people like Ernest Wilson, one of the early Kew plant collectors.
Absolutely, and the work that he did in the early 20th century, you know, from 1899 through till 1910 in China, who introduced more woody plants into horticulture than any other collector. And we were treading the same path that Wilson trod that many years ago. This is one of my favourite trees, I've got to say. That's why I brought you to it. This is the Chinese tulip tree, Liriodendron chinense, which was originally introduced by Ernest Wilson in the early 1900s from Sichuan. Highly threatened in the wild. In all the time that I've been to China, on many occasions, I've only ever seen one large tree of this. So it's quite rare now, but it's an amazing leaf, and the Chinese call it the Mandarin jacket tree or the goose foot tree.
Because the bottom part of the leaf looks like someone's cut it with
It is amazing, isn't it? It looks like someone's just put the scissors across the bottom of it, and why that is, I don't know. Maybe a deterrent to herbivores, and, you know, herbivore may come up to it, because it's a very primitive tree in Magnoliaceae. Herbivore may come up to it and think, I'm not going to eat that because something's had a go, doesn't like it, and left it. A fantastic tree. It's what I call a well-behaved tree. You can see that it's got that lovely straight trunk and beautiful lateral branching. So it's really well-behaved.
When we began our walk under the Turner Oak, you said that the immediate aftermath of the hurricane was all doom and gloom. But I sense that more benefits came out of it than you could have ever imagined.
When I look back now, in retrospect, I think so many good things have come from the hurricane. I think public awareness is raised, so people appreciate trees more and have more respect for them. We learned so much about tree roots. We reinvented tree planting techniques, and we've mounted many expeditions bringing new material back. Although it's one of the oldest arboreta in the world, it's now a young arboretum as well, with lots of young trees to go into the next century.
So the disturbance regime was a rejuvenation as well?
Absolutely. You know, the root work that we've learnt about, the decompaction work that's revitalised all these mature trees around us, is another plus from the hurricane.
It's been a delight walking around the arboretum. Tony Kirkham, thank you.
Plants from Roots to Riches was presented by Professor Kathy Willis. Join her again at the same time tomorrow when she'll be taking up her story in a vault deep underground in what's claimed to be the most biodiverse place in the world. The producer is Adrian Washburn. Mike will be in a quandary when we drop in on the Archers after the news, but first a word from John Wilson, who's in Edinburgh.
As part of Front Row's ongoing festival coverage this week, tonight I'll be talking to stand-up comedian Sarah Pascoe about her new show here in Edinburgh, which looks at sexual politics through the ages. Also, poet and playwright Sabrina Mahfouz tells me about Chef, her acclaimed new play set in the kitchen of a women's prison. Why Scottish doctors are turning to poetry to help their bedside manners. And why comedian Phil Jupitus is leading a series of art classes for festival early risers. Join me, John Wilson, for Front Row, Radio 4 this evening at 7:15.